Welcome into NHL at the Rink. We're recording this Tuesday afternoon. Dan Rosen here, and I'm joined by our jet-lagged international traveler, Sean Rourke, back in the seat to my right, fresh from Stockholm. Sean, how was your trip?
Fresh is relative, but the trip was awesome. 8 days in Stockholm with the Lightning, and then Buffalo came in a day or two later. So they had a little less time there, but a ton of time to spend with both teams, a ton of time to spend in what you know is a fantastic
phenomenal city.
Love it. All the meatballs I could eat. Learned a few new dishes in going out during the week.
And this isn't my thing, but I have been told that you found the metal bar, the heavy metal bar, or a great metal store in Stockholm.
I did. Sound Pollution. It's one of the greatest metal record stores in all of Europe. I also went to the Viking Museum and mentioned Amon Amarth, which is a very famous.
You wrote a postcard on that on NHL.com. I read that.
Blew up socially when Amon Amarth retweeted it, so now I'm famous.
And, Blew up is relative with that too, isn't it?
Yeah, I don't know. You'd be shocked, but now I'm famous among Amon Amarth fans, so it was a good trip all around.
Let's get to the teams you saw, specifically the Tampa Bay Lightning. They win both of those games against the Buffalo Sabres, and it seemed like, you know, everything was back to normal in, you know, for the Lightning after they win both of these games. What was your sense from Tampa Bay? I mean, do you buy that? Do you think that they found themselves and they're going to now take off from here?
I think they found pieces of themselves. I think what this week allowed them to do was they spent the first 3 days when they were in Stockholm getting off the plane on Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday. Heavy practices, a lot of teaching, spent it as almost a mini training camp. What I think is interesting is I talked to Steven Stamkos after one of those days, and he said, look, we're changing the way we play. We need to be a little more defensive. We need to think about what we're doing now so we don't think about it when the playoffs come. But they know that they're going to have to be a different team than they were this year in the playoffs and even during the regular season. So right now I think they're paralyzed by thinking about where they need to be, what they need to do on the defensive side of the puck. But eventually that's going to become second nature. I think you saw a little of it this weekend. I also think it's amazing when you get a little bit of depth scoring, right? Their fourth line, their so-called fourth line, nobody likes to be called that, of Pat Maroon, Paquette.
And Yanni Gourde
drove that whole series. I mean, without them, they don't win that series. It was them and the power play, special teams. Buffalo was not good at special teams, but that was the difference in each of these games.
Yeah, that fourth line had 9 points in those two games, 4 goals, 5 assists, 20 shots on goal, too, for that fourth line in those games. One of the things I liked about the Lightning in those two games, too, was their ability to get a lead and build on it and be resilient when they had it. It had been a problem for them going into those two games against Buffalo, yet there they were up 2-0 Friday. Buffalo cut it to 2-1, but the Lightning scored, and they made it 3-1, 3-2, and they held on. And they outshot the Sabres 6-1 in the last 8.5 minutes with the score 3-2 in that game to win it. They did a lot of the same in terms of getting a lead. Well, they gave up the first goal, I believe, in the first game, in the second game, got it back, built it up, and were able to play with the lead and play well with the lead. Like I said, going into that, they had really struggled. They were 1-1 against the Islanders. They gave up 3 in a row and lost 5-2. They had a wild 7-6 game against the Devils where they blew 3-1 goal leads. They gave up 4 in a row against the Rangers after scoring the first goal. So I think that was important for them to find that cohesiveness when they have it, build on it, be resilient with it.
And I don't think you can put enough stock in the fact that Victor Hedman was playing in those games. And that team desperately wanted to give Victor Hedman at least one, if not two, wins. He said it was the most emotional time in his NHL career. That first night when they played the national anthem, the Swedish national anthem, everybody in the globe sang it. Victor Hedman was on the verge of tears. Look, and Buffalo had their own Swede in Rasmus Dahlin, who desperately wanted to win. But Victor is a little more established. He's been with his team much longer. I think there was a huge unity there to try and give him something out of that. And you know, and then you look at what happened with Buffalo. They lose both games. They've lost 4 in a row now. But I think they're okay. Like, the one thing I learned about Buffalo and being there and being around Ralph Kruger a lot is he hasn't changed since the World Cup of Hockey. He is still a great motivator. He is still a great manager of men. I think he's teaching them something now. He's teaching them a system now that's going to pay off for them later. But they need help. Look, they're not there yet. They need third and fourth line scoring. I said the difference was the fourth line and the power play, and that's exactly what it was. There's nothing right now beyond those first two lines in Buffalo that can help them on a consistent basis. They need to be deeper.
Yeah, absolutely. A team that's relied on depth. I want to talk about a team that I just saw. I came right before we started recording this. I came from Madison Square Garden, where the Pittsburgh Penguins are playing the New York Rangers Tuesday night, and I was with them. I had a conversation with Justin Schultz. A little background. The Penguins are 10-6-1. Sidney Crosby won't play against the Rangers. He may not play against the Devils on Friday either. So he's hurt. Chris Letang's hurt. Patrick Hornquist is out, all with lower body injuries. Evgeny Malkin missed 11 games. But I talked to Justin Schultz. I said, why is this team able to withstand these injuries? We don't yet know if they'll withstand it without Crosby, but they've been okay in doing so already. And he said they're playing more as a team this season, more cohesive. They have an identity of being a responsible team right now, whereas last season he was talking about it was too much singular play, individual play, and it would end up in two-on-ones and three-on-twos against. They're not giving up a lot of those odd-man rushes, and their depth is coming through. So here are the Pittsburgh Penguins with all of these injuries, and I don't know of many teams that would be able to survive injuries to these types of players, sitting there at 10-6-1 going into their game against the Rangers on Tuesday and feeling as though they're going to be fine without Sidney Crosby too.
I think that's whistling a little bit past the graveyard. You're talking about probably one of the two best centers in the league. Chris Letang is an all-class defenseman. It makes everything happen, right? And Hornquist is that net front presence. Their number one center now, who's it going to be? McCann?
Well, Malkin.
So their number two is going to be McCann.
Jared McCann.
Never scored more than 35 points in a year in his career.
And not to interrupt, well, to interrupt you, because I just did. We talk about this. Look, the reason that they were able to withstand the Malkin injury is a big reason of that is Sidney Crosby and Jake Guentzel stepped up. So the two questions you have now with Crosby out of the lineup, and we don't know how long he's going to be out, is will Evgeny Malkin step up? He talks so much about how he re-energized his training, you know, put himself back into that mode this offseason, got hurt in the first game, hasn't really been there, but he's the guy who's got 160 points in 120 games played without Crosby in the lineup. He typically steps up when Crosby's not there. He has to now. And will Jake Guentzel be the same player? This is a good player in Jake Guentzel, made to be so much better because he's played with Sidney Crosby. I don't want to take away what Guentzel can do, but his entire time with the Penguins, we've seen him with Crosby. So how is he going to be with Jared McCann as opposed to Sidney Crosby? These are going to be some interesting questions that are going to get answered relatively soon here because, again, and we also don't know we don't know the severity of the injury with Crosby and how long he's going to be out.
No, and you know what I'm most interested in seeing? Well, there's two things. One is Matt Murray's going to have to be really good for them. And the second thing is maybe now people are going to realize how good Brian Dumoulin is for that team.
He's terrific. He's an excellent defenseman, and has played a great yin to Chris Letang's yang for them, and I think has been good in all that time Letang has been out of the lineup. He was one of their best players when they won the Cup without Letang.
Yeah, but I still think people look at that team, and I just did it when we started this. I said Letang's an all-world defenseman.
He is, though.
Of course he is, but I think, you know, Dumoulin kind of sits in that background, and I think he's okay with it, but he's more than a complimentary player. I think he's fantastic. I think he's one of the best defensive defensemen in the game we have right now.
Before we get to our first guest, Sean, who's Keith Jones from NBC, we're going to talk about the Flyers and go around the league with Keith. We do have to talk about arguably the biggest news story in hockey right now, and that is Don Cherry no longer being with Sportsnet, no longer being on Hockey Night in Canada. Unfortunately, there were things said on Hockey Night in Canada, divisive comments that Don Cherry made Saturday night, and it has blown up, and it's gotten to the point where Sportsnet had to let him go. A controversial figure who has said controversial things throughout an entire time on television went over the line here, and Sportsnet let him go. You cannot condone the comments at all. You can appreciate Don Cherry's run on Hockey Night in Canada and his impact on Canadians in general, but we can't condone what was said, and now it's an opportunity for somebody else to step into this role, another personality, maybe a more modernized personality, to step into this role, this giant pulpit that is Hockey Night in Canada, and make an impact on the next generation of hockey fans in Canada and really across North America.
And I don't know who that's going to be, and there's been candidates thrown out. I know Brian Burke's been mentioned. There's other candidates that would certainly be good for it. But I don't know that anybody's ever going to have the impact that Don Cherry had. It's a different world now. Everything is so stratified. You can listen to whatever you want during intermission. You can walk away. There's other games. You can go on your tablet. It's first intermission in the Hockey Night in Canada game. You can go watch another game. So I don't know that it's the appointment viewing for the younger generation than it was. Look, when I grew up and I started watching hockey and I started covering hockey and you had access to Hockey Night in Canada, it was appointment viewing. It was a cultural event that happened. And I think it's lost a lot of that as it's gone along. And Don did. He had an unbelievable run, you know, four or five decades. Multiple generations of Canadians have grown up listening to him. But there's been other broadcasters like that in our lifetimes, and eventually they fade into the past and you move on. And I will say, whoever is lucky enough to get this opportunity, as you mentioned, one of the best in hockey, is going to have some big shoes to fill and may never reach the audience that was available even 20 years ago.
I think the key thing you said there, Sean, is lucky enough to get that spot, because it is such a great platform to talk the game on Hockey Night in Canada. Now it's time to get to our first guest, Keith Jones. He's in Stamford right now, getting ready for the NBC games this week. And we're going to whip around the league with Keith, but we're going to start close to home for him with the Philadelphia Flyers. But first, Keith, thanks for joining us. How's everything?
I'm doing well, Dan. Everything's going well so far. The season's off to a very good start, and we're starting to get some answers to some of the questions coming into training camp and into the start of the regular season.
Do we have any answers yet on the Philadelphia Flyers? That's where I wanted to start. It's a team you're close with, obviously. 5-0-1 in their last six since closing October with a 7-1 loss. What do you make of where the Flyers are right now and the impact that Alain Vigneault is having?
Yeah, they're better. There's no doubt about that. They're better than they were last year. I think a lot of it has to do with the structure that Alain Vigneault has put in place. The concentration in the offseason was about making the special teams better. Mike Yeo was brought in to handle the penalty kill and has done an outstanding job. They've been much improved. They're not relying entirely on goaltending to come up with big saves and preserve some of the penalty kill. It's all about positioning, and some of that has to do with Mike Yeo, and some of it has to do with personnel. Some of the additions that Chuck Fletcher made in the offseason certainly have helped in that regard. Michel Therrien was brought in to help the power play, and he's done a terrific job in that department as well. So those things, with Alain Vigneault in charge of all of it, really provided the Flyers with some hope this season.
You talked about some of the changes that have been made. The one that's really struck me, at least early on, has been Matt Niskanen on the blue line, you know, traded here from Washington for Ratko Gudas. It seems like it's been a huge upgrade. What impact has he had with them?
Pretty much in all areas. You know, we talked about special teams. He's excellent both on the power play, on the second unit, which at times has looked like the number one unit. And on the penalty kill, he does a great job in that regard, whether it's blocking a shot or using a stick to take away a pass. Plays the game with great intelligence, and you can tell he's won a cup before because he has a great confidence in the way that he goes about doing his thing. Very important for the younger Flyer defensemen that are continuing to grow to have a player like Niskanen to talk with, to look up to watch on the ice and sit beside on the bench. I think he's been a really important addition to the team, and he's been their most consistent performer, whether it's breaking up a 4-on-1, a 2-on-1, or an odd man rush, which he has done frequently. Those type of things go a long way in helping a younger defenseman and a younger D core continue to gain confidence as they play, because the puck's not being picked out of their back of the net because of a subtle play defensively by Matt Niskanen. And all of those things, the leadership and everything else, have really contributed to the Flyers playing better defensively, and Niskanen deserves a lot of credit for that.
They're better defensively, but they're getting the quality goaltending too. And I have to ask you about Carter Hart. 4-0 with a .929 save percentage and a .192 goals against average in November. So much is being placed on Carter Hart as a number one and for hopefully a long time in Philadelphia. Why, in your mind, is he built for sustained success as a number one in Philly?
because he's already demonstrated in a short time that he can bounce back from a period where he's not playing as well. And that happened earlier this year. He did not have his A game going. He struggled for three or four games in a row. Brian Elliott was brought in and provided outstanding goaltending, which I think obviously helps a younger netminder. It's not on all on his shoulders. A healthy Elliott is helping provide some support. But Carter Hart never lets it get to him. He just continues to show that he has the mental fortitude to be a number one netminder in the league. He has the athletic ability to do that as well. And he reads the play, anticipates where the shot is coming from, as well as any young netminder that I've watched in the game. So I think all of those things combined give Flyer fans great hope that he is ultimately going to be the guy that answers all those questions that have been in goal really since the time that Ron Hextall arrived going back, you know, 30 or more years ago.
So, Keith, I'm curious, are you a glass half full guy or a glass half empty guy? You look at the Flyers, Drew's fourth in scoring. The JVR is seventh, Voracek's fifth, I think, and they're where they are, and they've played well this month. Is this a cause for concern that they're not providing, or is it a cause for optimism that once they get going, they're going to be an even better team?
Yeah, I would say half full. I mean, they're starting to show signs, and there has been games along the way where they've been dominant players, which you would expect from guys that have done that throughout their careers. But there's enough young talent here that if they're not on their game, they don't have to be on the ice all the time. In fact, they're not going to be on the ice all the time with Alain Vigneault. He is great at recognizing so far which players are going and rewarding those players on a game-to-game basis based on their play. And I think that kind of type of coaching breeds success down the road. And short-term, it's worked so far, but I think in the long-term, it's going to have an even greater effect. Because there's such a amount of responsibility put on each individual player that you're forced to make sure you're playing the game the right way or you're going to be sitting on the bench. And no veteran player or young player wants to be the guy that's left out, especially when the team is having some measure of success. So I think it turns around. I think they both, you know, Giroux, Voracek, and the players that you mentioned find their game, and there'll be moments where they're going to need to carry the team with their offensive production, and I believe that they will.
Let's bounce to the team that they play Wednesday night, and you guys have the game, Keith, on NBCSN. The Washington Capitals, are they the best team in the NHL right now?
They are. They are the toughest team to play against, especially when you're trying to defend. I think they have some weakness on their back end, which gives me pause when I think about the best teams in the league, because St. Louis's blue line is just so much better than any other blue line that I've watched so far this year. They are much better than the Capitals in that regard, but Washington has so much power, whether it's on the power play with the skill that they have or if it's in the corner with the power that they can knock you over with. I love the way that their team is built. I think they're built for a long run and obviously have a certain amount of confidence based upon what they did a couple of seasons ago. So I would consider them the most dangerous team in the league. And I think the trade deadline, there is some red flags as far as adding additional depth on the back end. But those type of things can be done rather easily by Brian McLellan because he has so much depth to deal with up front.
Do you believe that John Carlson and what he's done is sustainable throughout the whole year?
I do. I think he's in a position where he's going to take all the prime minutes on the back end. We talked about Niskanen leaving earlier and heading over to the Flyers, a right-handed shooting defenseman that would play substantial minutes on the back end. Carlson's now asked to pretty much do all of it from the right side. He's their most gifted player, and he's the type of player on the power play that you want to put the puck in his hands, whether he's passing it or shooting the one-timer from the point. He's demonstrated that he has the ability to make the right decisions at the appropriate times and not just defer to Ovechkin's shot down in the bottom of the circle. So I don't see it slowing down. Obviously, injury would play or cause concern if he does get banged up. But if he stays healthy, I think he continues to rack up the points. And the pace he's on, he's going to have himself in that conversation for the Norris Trophy.
Keith, I wanted to go to Dallas with you because it's Tyler Seguin and Jamie Benn, four goals between them, which is mind-boggling to me that these two guys have four goals between them, three for Seguin and one for Benn. And Jim Montgomery got on there, not naming names, but certainly got on and said our top players need to be better. Last year they got blasted by Jim Leitz. Is there legit concern in Dallas about these two being together in Dallas for very much longer? Can they coexist now?
Shockingly, it's become a story.
Yeah.
And, I mean, there's no avoiding it. And when you watch them play, something's missing. And you're waiting for Jamie Benn to get his game back up to the, you know, the level of play that he demonstrated he's capable of doing, and I'm not seeing it. The jump's not there in his legs. And, you know, that's a major concern, especially when the player's not coming back from some type of major injury. It's a mysterious thing to me, and I think Jim Montgomery is appropriate in going after, you know, the players that they are looking to provide offense for their hockey club. And Jamie Benn provides a lot of different elements, including physicality, but that's dropping off right now as well. And it's very difficult to lead when your point production is so dramatically affected right now. So I that's a major concern to me. Seguin, for me, that is also mind-boggling. The younger players on the Dallas Stars are keeping them afloat, and that's not a recipe for success when the season gets to about the midway point. So I would give them a few more weeks, and then I'd be worried that in Dallas they'll be waving the white flag because they're going to need those guys if they're going to be a Stanley Cup contending team. You could look to St. Louis a year ago and say, look at some of their star players were slow to get going, and eventually they found their game with the help of the supporting cast and went on to win a Stanley Cup. But looking at a team to do that in back-to-back seasons is a long stretch. So Dallas better fix it in a hurry. I wouldn't wait till January to get Benn and Seguin going.
Yeah, we've heard that so much this season too, Keith, right? A team gets off to a slow start. They say, well, the Blues did it. I mean, it's not necessarily a recipe for success long-term. I wanted to ask you about the Blues. Troy Brouwer, Jamie McGinn, a couple of veteran guys signed PTOs in the wake of, obviously, injuries to Tarasenko and Alex Steen. Do you think either of these guys have any game left to help St. Louis?
If they do, Craig Berube will find a way to get it out of them.
Yeah.
He is the type of coach that appreciates veteran players as long as they're able to provide what he is looking for them to provide. And that would be physicality. That would be leadership. That would be doing all the little things right that allow your team to win hockey games. He is going to hold those players accountable, and they're both pretty proud guys that have had, you know, good hockey careers in the NHL and now are getting one more chance to make it. So I would suspect that he'll be able to squeeze them just enough to get something out of them that will provide the Blues a spark. If it's not happening, they're not going to be there, but it's worth a shot right now as the Blues try to buy some time to get some of their top players back down the road. I'm interested to watch it, to say the least. I'm curious to see what Craig Berube can get out of both veteran players.
Keith, last one for me, and I'm going to keep you in the West for a little bit. Maybe the biggest news so far this week is the Arizona Coyotes extended John Chyka. And the Coyotes have made incremental gains. They almost made the playoffs last year. They've started out well this year. Some defensive issues holding leads against Washington on Monday night. They had a little bit of problem, end up winning the game. I'm curious what you think of where the Coyotes are now and what John's been able to do with them during his time there.
I think they're a playoff bubble team. I think they're a team that in a lot of ways reminds me of the Carolina Hurricanes. They've got a coach in Rick Tocchet that seems to know how to push the right buttons, that seems to maximize the potential of the players that are playing in front of them. I like their blue line. It's a little bit different without Jarmelson there right now, and I think that's why we're seeing some teams come from behind against them. When he gets back in there, I think that kind of changes that dynamic. I think John Chyka has done a very good job in building the team with limited resources. He's not overspending. He has made some interesting trades, including the one that brought Schmaltz over from the Chicago Blackhawks, you know, trading two former first-round picks and Perlini and Strom, and getting one, you know, 20th overall pick back, who looks like he's going to be a very good player in Arizona. I like the Kessel addition. Like to see him get going, but I think he eventually will with Rick Tocchet at the helm. Those two seem to work well together. And they've got some young star power in Clayton Keller, and I'm a big fan of the way that Connor Garland plays the game as well. So there's enough pieces there to make the playoffs, and I think they're a fun team to watch play, and fans in Arizona at least have a team that they can get behind.
Keith, last one from us. I'm sitting next to Sean, who's getting over some jet lag, trying to get as he came back from Stockholm. I think he's handling himself quite well, though, by the way. He obviously found some fun there. The Lightning say they found themselves there. They found their game. You buying that? You buying that the Lightning found the recipe for success this season over in Stockholm?
One of them's having Hedman back consistently. That would certainly go a long way in helping them find their game. I'm not 100% convinced yet. I have to see more. I'm a big believer in everything the Lightning have done, with the exception of what happened in the first round last year. And to me, they're going to be tested when the playoffs roll around. They put themselves in that type of position and under that type of spotlight. So great to see them start to get their game going. They're an extremely fun team to watch play. One of my favorites to watch, and one of the ones that I'd love to see win a Stanley Cup. But they demonstrated last year that they have some weaknesses. So a lot of what happens with Tampa, in my eyes, is going to be when the end of the regular season rolls around and the playoffs start. They're that good. I think they automatically put themselves in a position to be in the playoffs. What they do when the playoffs arrive is what's going to be most important in my eyes.
Absolutely. Agree with you 100%. Keith, thanks so much for running around the league with us today, all right?
Glad to do it, guys. Take care.
You can watch Keith on the NBCSN broadcast Tuesday night. They got Pittsburgh and the Rangers Wednesday, Washington and Philadelphia, as we talked about, along with Vegas and Chicago. One of the teams we talked about with Keith, the Dallas Stars. I'll give you some numbers. Tyler Seguin has 11 points. Jamie Benn has 6. 4 goals between them, Sean, as we talked about. Benn is shooting 2.6%. 1 goal on 38 shots. Seguin, 5.5%. 3 goals on 55 shots. Benn is around 13% for his career. Sagan's around 11%. I have to think the dam's going to break here. At some point, these guys are going to get back to the way that we expect them to be. And because their percentages are so low, there's a hot streak coming for both of them.
Well, I think that's true, and I think that's what happened last year. But let me give you some other numbers. Their top three scorers have 11, 11, and 10 points. That's 31 points. Leon Draisaitl has 35 points.
Yeah.
Like, when in Dallas are they going to point the finger at somebody else, right? You got these two guys, and they deserve a lot of blame. They make a lot of money, but there's nobody helping them out. There is nobody up front helping these two guys out.
No.
You can game plan against the Dallas Stars because you take those two guys away. If they're struggling, it becomes that much easier. But even when they're on, you take those two guys away. Where's their secondary scoring?
I also think there's an issue with they have gone very defensive, Dallas. And I think that's taken away from what Benn and Seguin are capable of doing. I mentioned the numbers. They're shooting less. Like, I think Sagan's got one less shot per game this season. To me, that's a coach saying, we need to tighten up defensively. I think with these two guys, you have to let them go free. You have to let them have the freedom to play a little offense, because the numbers suggest they're going to score eventually, but not if they're in such a tight area and they're feeling tight and they're so worried about defending, because they are a good defensive team, but if they're so worried about that, it obviously is hurting their offensive game. We're seeing it in the numbers. They have to let them go free.
Oh, I agree. And you got a really good goalie there. Like, open it up a little. Do what Tampa Bay did, you know, during the regular season last year, and let him steal some games for you and find your offense. And, you know you can bring it back. You know you can reel it back when everything becomes a little tighter in the playoffs. So I think at the price of getting those guys going, maybe you do open it up a little bit.
Yeah, and let's flip to another team, stay in the West. Calgary Flames, you talk about a good goalie going. David Rittich, 4-0-1 with a .922 save percentage and a .251 goals against average. You know, in his last five starts, the Flames are 4-1-1 since October 31st, but I think the biggest difference is Rittich. And that alarms me a little bit, that the goalie is making the biggest difference in a team's success right now. Because otherwise, like, Matthew Tkachuk's been good, and you're getting a little bit more out of Monahan and Johnny Gaudreau, and Lindholm's been solid, but nothing drastically different from those guys. The goalie's been good. And another thing to look at with Calgary, they're once again doing it in the third period. They were dominant in the third period last season. 118 goals for, that was the best in the third period. 64 against, that was the best in the league. They're doing it again. They're outscoring the opposition 10-3 in the third in their past six games, 12-4 when you include overtime. Is that a recipe for success, sustained success? I don't know.
Well, I think it is with the Bill Peters team, right? Like, when you think about that,
yeah.
What do you think about? They're going to
I'm
be
hesitant.
They're going to be defensively sound, and they're going to be in as good, if not a better shape than any team in the league, and they're going to skate you to death. Like, that's what they do out there. They just skate you into the ground, you know. And but one of those losses in there, I think, is when they blew the lead in the Heritage Classic, and that's what would concern me. I mean, they had control of that game, and then they give up a late goal, and then they give up the overtime goal, and I think that woke them up a little bit. I don't care what you say. When teams play on big stages, they take those games seriously. And they knew they had an opportunity to make a statement against Winnipeg, and they blew it at the end. They gave it up, and I think they walked away from there, and they went on a long road trip, and I think they got together out west, and they said, I'm sorry, in Carolina, and they said, you know what, we can't do this. We have to be better, and they have been since.
Well, yeah, but then they play the Blues, who are one of the best teams in the league, and it's an overtime loss 3-2, but they're down 2-0, and they need to rally in the third period. Again, look, last year they did this all throughout the regular season, and they were one of the best teams in the regular season. We know that. Then they got into the playoffs, and they were gone in five games. So, to me, a successful team, yeah, Tampa Bay is another great example. We see what they do in the regular season, but it's about playing the type of hockey you need to play in the playoffs in the regular season. Tampa Bay clearly didn't do that last year. I question about it this year, and I don't know that Calgary's doing it either.
Well, maybe they're like writers. Maybe they love a deadline. Right? I write way better on a deadline. Third period's their deadline. They're off to the races. So maybe there's a bunch of writers on that team.
Well, let's get to one of the best on deadline. How about that? You like that segue?
I do.
Yeah, let's go back. We'll stay in Canada, go back east to our colleague, Mike Zeisberger, covers the Toronto Maple Leafs and really the whole NHL for us. But Toronto, obviously, in the news with the Mitch Marner injury. Mike, how you doing?
Oh, yeah. Welcome to the drama capital of the National Hockey League. Oh, and by the way, welcome to January, where I have just spent the morning shoveling almost a foot of snow out of my driveway. It is November, right? Did I miss, like, January?
I don't know. I was about to question if you thought it was January. I thought you were thinking it was January, and we were getting a little ahead of ourselves, you know?
You know what? I was thinking that when I was shoveling the you-know-what this morning, and far too much of it.
At least you had your ankles on straight. Mitch Marner didn't think his was. This injury, he's out at least 4 weeks. He spoke Tuesday to the media there. What's the impact here? What's the rundown here with the impact on losing Marner?
Well, I think there's layers to this, Dan. Number one, you're losing. You know, you can debate who has the most raw talent on this team, whether it's Matthews or Marner, but I mean, you're losing one of the most skilled players in the National Hockey League. So that's a big hit. Number two, because the Maple Leafs have, you know, gone top heavy at forward, their depth seems to fall off a little bit. I mean, after you get past Tavares and Matthews, Johnson, Kapanen. I hate this word because we use it all the time, but it matters, and that is somebody's got to step up for him in the lineup. This is a team that has struggled to find chemistry in the first 5 weeks of the season, and he's not going to be there. He's been one of their best penalty killers on a team that doesn't kill penalties all that well. So the impact is there too. And number three, and this is not so much about the team, but it's about the rabid fan base, which sometimes goes over the edge. This is hardly breaking news, but you've got people going, oh, the Leafs, you know, there's more hard luck because Tavares had been out with a finger fracture, a couple weeks before that. And it's just, you know, from purely personal point of view, it gets nauseating a little bit sometimes because, you know, here's a message to Leaf fans, okay? Go look at Colorado right now. They're without Rantanen. They're without Landeskog. The St. Louis Blues are without Tarasenko. You are going to suffer key injuries during a season. That happens in hockey. Okay? So now the Leafs, they spent a lot of money on Austin Matthews. They spent a lot of money on William Nylander. Okay? It's time for these guys. These guys have to find a way to win. The other night in Chicago, I mean, Matthews had 4 points. Nylander's been playing well. They still lost 5-4. Maybe they have to play a more defensive style. But I'm tired of hearing this excuse of, oh, the poor Maple Leafs, because when you look at it, you look at what, like I said, what's going on in Colorado. Colorado's without two of their three best forwards. So, you know what? Come back and talk to me if God forbid, Matthews or Nylander gets hurt, because then you get into that conversation. But, you know, losing one key guy, you got to find a way to get past that. Nobody's throwing crying towels over Toronto for the Maple Leafs.
Wow. You're bringing the heat. I like it. So you're telling me that Kyle Dubas goes out and spends all this money on offense. He's got maybe two really good offensive defensemen. He goes five deep with Tavares and Matthews, yep, and all those guys driving the offense, and you want him to play more of a defensive style?
Yeah. Yeah, I do. I think you have to. And one of the reasons for that, Sean, and you guys definitely are the sultans of segues, because we're getting into one right here. But one of the reasons is, you look at the other night in Chicago. I talked about the 5-4 game. They peppered the Hawks with Leonard with 57 shots, which you don't, you know, we've seen some one-sided games. But when you get into the high 50s, okay, when you're ready to crack a 50 burger, or 60 burger, I should say, when you're getting close to that and you still can't win, there's issues at the other end. They've been, you know, the chances they give up are far, you know, are too many grade A chances. And frankly, after Freddie Anderson, their backup goalies haven't been able to make a save. You know, you got to make a save in that situation, because they are so strapped under the cap, because they're so tight to the ceiling. You know, a guy like Curtis McElhinney, who would be perfect here. He was great 2 years ago, and they let him go. They tried the Garrett Sparks experiment. That didn't work. Michael Hutchison, we just talked about, was winless this year. Mike Babcock decides that Freddie Anderson plays the first game of back-to-backs, and then his backup plays the second. Well, you know what? They've had 5 back-to-back games this year, and they've won 0 of them. So Hutchison was put on waivers yesterday. Today they called up a kid from the Toronto Marlies. And, you know, I am going to butcher this name. I apologize. I'm sure he's listening to the podcast.
Definitely.
He doesn't. But Kazimier Kaskisuo, or is it Kazimier, which would be one of my favorite Led Zeppelin songs. But, yeah, we'll go with Kazimier Kaskisuo. I will apologize for that, for butchering his name.
I think you nailed it.
I've done that, but you know what? I mean, this kid's going to get a chance, but the Leafs, you know, the way that the salary structure has been, you know, and Sean mentioned this, the way that it's been set up here, when you're paying so much money, I think 40% of their salary cap goes to their top three or four, to their top four forwards. You know, this is a situation that you're going to get yourself into. So we'll have to see how this kid plays.
Want to stay? I think that's enough on the Leafs. I think we covered it all right there, Zies. But let's.
I was just getting on a roll. Come on.
Got to cut you off. We got to go to another team. Stay in the division, though. We'll stay. We'll
commercial go to the break.
We'll go to the Montreal Canadiens, a team that would probably be dying for one of those forwards. Doesn't have it yet. They're 5-1-1 in a stretch now that started with a 5-2 win against those Toronto Maple Leafs. What do you make of the Canadiens? Do you get a sense, Zies, if they are for real, if they are a legit playoff contender yet?
You know what? I think well, you know what, Dan? I mean, when you look at it, look how close they came last year. Were they, a point out?
They were. I think they had two fewer wins than the Leafs last year.
Yeah, and I mean, this some cliches are legit. And the cliche that if you have Carey Price in net, you've always got a chance, that's legit. I mean, this is a guy that can win any type of game. So then you're looking at this team going, okay, like Petrie's played well. Shea Weber's a little banged up, but I think to this point, this is as good as I've seen Shea play in a Montreal Canadiens uniform since he came over in that deal for PK Subban. So, and some of the youngsters, 2 years ago, the cupboard was pretty bare, but you know, in the Pacioretty trade, they got Nick Suzuki. He's shown some flashes. There's a few of these kids that are picking their games up. So I think with the Montreal Canadiens, they've just got it. They just got to stay within the pack. And if it comes down to, you know, the last week or two of the season, and they're not chasing it kind of like they were last year, and they just came up a little bit short. If they're in the pack or in a position, you know, going into the last 2 weeks of the season, hey, I'll put my money on Carey Price. When I look at the goalies around the league, I still think this is as consistent a guy as there is.
So the guy who's actually leading them in scoring right now is Jonathan Drouin. Is this the Jonathan Drouin that they traded for and took so long to arrive, or is this just a start of the season hot streak?
Well, let's hope so for the Montreal Canadiens' sakes, Sean, because I remember being in Kraft Hockeyville in New Brunswick where the Canadiens played the Florida Panthers. Just a wonderful event. There's a big French-Canadian population there. And as the Habs were coming down the red carpet, Jonathan Drouin was just a guy who was very generous with his time. But, you know, I mean, people can say what they want about this, but you know, it still matters, you know, in Eastern Canada and Quebec or the Maritimes, within the Francophone population, to have that element, you know, a homebred guy as a Montreal Canadian. So there's so many people that want to see him succeed. With that comes a hell of a lot of pressure. And I'll tell you what, he was invisible in that game. He was invisible in two other exhibition games that I covered involving the Canadiens. There was a lot of fretting among the fan base and the media. So good on Jonathan Drouin, because he's looked like a different player from the preseason. You know, I remember, Sean, his first couple of years in Tampa. This guy's a special player. I mean, he has some God-given skill set. He can do things out on the ice that no coach can teach. You know, what's been questioned at times, even in Montreal, by the media and the fan base, is how much heart and desire does he have? Well, he's showing it. And, you know, you couple that with Max Domi, who we've never questioned about those two elements, and who just thrives in the spotlight of being a Montreal Canadian. And all of a sudden, you know, you can see these two guys, and obviously with Brendan Gallagher as well, one of the more feistier players in the league, you can see the type of chemistry that could really take this team far. If Jonathan Drouin doesn't start wilting under the pressure, and like I said, there's a lot of it for the Montreal Canadiens, of a home, you know, a Quebec boy playing in the spotlight of the Bleu Blanc Rouge. I think that is very, very important, because skill has never been a question mark for Jonathan Drouin.
I'll try the segue again here, Zyes, talking about skill and a player get traded. Let's stay in the division again with the Detroit Red Wings. They just get Robbie Fabry. So I'm at Madison Square Garden the night they made this trade. It's after the game. Rangers beat the Red Wings 5-1, and I see the trade come through. Jacob De La Rose goes from Detroit to St. Louis, Robbie Fabry in return. And I turn to the Detroit beat writers. I'm like, hey, did you realize the Red Wings just made a trade? It like barely even registered with them. And I think it didn't really register a ton nationally either. But here comes Robbie Fabry, a very talented player who's been banged up with knee injuries, gets two goals against the Bruins in a win, an assist against Vegas in a win. You think Robbie Fabry might find something here? Is this the first steal for Steve Yzerman?
Well, you know what? It very much may be. I'll tell you what. I remember seeing Robbie Fabry at the World Juniors a few years ago playing for Team Canada. And the fact that he's on that team shows you just how highly regarded he was in junior hockey. And that's where he suffered one of his first injuries, and you just felt, you felt sick for the kid. And he's gone through a few of these, and you just wonder when it keeps happening over and over again, you know, is this kid going to be able to reinvent himself physically, mentally? You know, for some reason, it just it never really kicked in St. Louis. He had a few injuries there. But, yeah, I think, you know, Steve Yzerman, and this is no offense to the kid going the other way, but, you know, Steve Yzerman didn't give up much. I think that he sees the top end, the ceiling, how high it is for Robbie Fabry. And let's face it, Detroit's got to take chances. Yzerman's got to roll the dice. I mean, the skill set of that team, you know, you get past Larkin and Mantha. There are some good young players there. But, I mean, Steve knows that, you know, yeah, the Wings are rebuilding. But, you know, he doesn't want this thing to go 5-10 years. So you got to take chances. And I think that, you know, so far so good from what we've seen. And let's face it, guys, if you're a kid that's questioning yourself because you've had some hard luck early in your career, and then Steve Yzerman walks up to you and said, look, I believe in you. You know, I'm giving you this chance. Aren't you like boosted by, you know, when a Hall of Famer like that puts his confidence in you? You know I would be. And I think that this is something that hopefully, you know, kickstarts Robbie Fabry's career again.
And let's not forget in this deal the role that Armstrong played in it, right? Like, he knew that he was getting he was going to be on the bad end of this deal. He needed to do something with Robbie Fabry. He needed to give him a chance, and not every GM would do that. So it's a steal, but it's not as big a steal as you think. But before we let you go, Zeiss, I want to touch base a little bit. We're all going to be together next week in your hometown. Hopefully the snow is not 3 feet high by then. But we're all going to be there for a Hockey Hall of Fame weekend, which is one of the best weekends of the year. The latest class, the class of 2019, is going in, and what are you most excited about for this weekend?
You know what? There's not really anything specific. I mean, I love the Monday night. I mean, the alumni game is kind of cool, and the Q&As and all that. But the congregation of so many great players, past and present, and hockey people. On the Monday night for the official inductions. It is so cool. And I'll just give you guys a quick story of why it is. I mean, obviously in this country, you know, the 72 Summit Series, it was such a big thing. I mean, I remember it being in like grade 7 or 8, and school was canceled for the final game between Canada and the Soviet Union. And we all sat in the gymnasium watching on a little TV as Paul Henderson scored in the last minute of game 8 past Vladislav Tretiak. So a couple of years ago, you know, I'm standing there, as you guys know, there's the red carpet, and it's such a cool event as all the dignitaries come in. And all of a sudden, somebody taps me on the shoulder, and I look over my shoulder, and it's Vladislav Tretiak. And he puts out his hand, and he goes, Mike, it's always great to see you. And even at my middle age, no comments, please. you know, I just, for a second, it was surreal. It's like Vladislav Tretiak, like, came up and said hi to me. That's the same guy that was, like, on TV when I was sitting in that gymnasium in 1972. And, you know, there's those moments, like, we're lucky. And I don't have to preach this to you guys, but we're really lucky that we get to do what we do, okay? We're, as somebody put it to me the other day, we're in the toy department, okay? We don't really work in the real world. And I think moments like that and moments like we'll experience on Monday night just kind of refreshes that thought process that, you know what, man, we got it pretty good.
The only thing that would have made that story better was if he had called you Zeiss instead of Mike. Did you yell at him?
I don't know what the translation is of Zeiss in Russian. I'm kind of scared that it's probably not too flattering, although it probably deserves not to be flattering. So I didn't want to go there. I'll I'll take what I can get, Sean, and Mike was fine for me, thanks.
Well, next week when I see you, I'll put my hand on your shoulder and say, Mike, it's great to see you. I hope you get the same feeling as you did with Tretiak.
Well, that obviously will supersede anything that I got from Vladislav Tretiak.
There you go. Made my day. Zeiss, thanks so much for joining us on the podcast today. Thanks.
Anytime, guys. Thanks for having me.
See you in a couple of days.
Sean, it's always interesting to chat with Zeiss, isn't it? And you can follow him on Twitter, at Zeissberger. We talked about the Hall of Fame, and he gave a great story on Vladislav Tretiak and what it means, but we never actually mentioned who's actually going into the Hall of Fame. So let's do that now. You've got Guy Carboneau, Vaclav Nedimansky, Sergei Zubov, and Haley Wickenheiser in the player category, Jerry York and Jim Rutherford in the builders category, Frank Brown, longtime executive here at the NHL. Prior to that, a longtime writer, covered some of the greatest events in hockey. He's getting the Elmer Ferguson Memorial Award, and Jim Hewson gets the Foster Hewitt Memorial Award. And before we recorded, John, I was saying I wouldn't have minded if this, in terms of the players, if this was just Haley Wickenheiser's class because of the impact she's had on the game. And I want to say the women's game, but really it's the game in general, and how important she is. She's sort of like the Wayne Gretzky of women's hockey, especially in Canada. I would have been okay with that if it was just her in the players category. Then you started talking about Sergei Zubov, and I think you convinced me.
Well, I'm glad I convinced somebody. First, before we get to Zubov's qualifications, if you haven't had a chance, go read our profiles on NHL.com. They'll be running all week. Nick Kostanica did the Haley Wickenheiser one. Some of the stories that he got that led her to be the greatest women's player in the history of the game are unbelievable. Turning her farm into a gym like Rocky, using a wheelbarrow with rocks, like stuff like that. Going out and skating at midnight under the sun, under the moon, trying to mimic what Wayne Gretzky had done. Just unbelievable stuff. Like, that's the drive that leads these people to the Hall
of Fame. Her father going downstairs to get a glass of water in the middle of the night and looks outside and there's Haley skating on the ice out there.
Yeah, no, unbelievable stuff. One of the most interesting people in hockey. Not women, one of the most interesting people in hockey. But Zubov, like, he's been a controversial candidate since he got in. Look, the guy scored more than 50 points 8 times in his NHL career. Won 2 cups. That 94 cup, he played with Brian Leetch, who arguably was the greatest defenseman of his generation. I don't know that you'd find many people that would pick somebody else. Zubov was pretty good that year and is a huge reason why they won that cup, lifted the curse, everything that went with it. He's been good for Russia internationally. It is the Hockey Hall of Fame. It is not the NHL Hall of Fame. It's the Hockey Hall of Fame. I think what Sergei Zubov has done in his career and the way he was one of the modern offensive defensemen in the game during those years that he played certainly merits being in the Hall of Fame. I will argue with anybody about that.
I also want to give a shout out to Jim Rutherford too for his accomplishments. He wins the cup with Carolina, and then it was a bit of a struggle in terms of trying to build it right in Carolina. Moves over to Pittsburgh, gets the people in place he wants in place, and just seemed to have the magic touch as a general manager with those back-to-back Penguins championships. So certainly deserving as well for Jim Rutherford.
Oh, my God, and look at his tree, right? Yeah. You want to talk about executive trees. You look at Jim Rutherford, and everywhere you look, there's somebody that he's mentored, you know, going all the way back to the very beginning of his career. So, and you know what? His speech is going to be fantastic on Monday. I can't wait to hear it. One of the true personalities in our game.
Absolutely. So let's look ahead, though. Let's look at next year. Jerome Iginla, I think, is a lock to get in the Hall of Fame next year. And then it's sort of open. Marian Hossa is in his first year of eligibility. Look, if you want to take a close look at what Marian Hossa has done in his career, certainly Hall of Fame worthy. And I've been stumping it for a while. I think Alexander Mogilny, once Paul Kariya got in, I think a Mogilny should be a Hall of Famer. He's waited. Maybe next year's his turn.
And he changed the game.
Yeah.
Like, forget what he scored and what he did. He changed the game. He was the guy that came over and basically said, I'm going to play in the NHL. I'm going to play in the best league there is. I don't care what it means for me personally, what it means back home. Like, I'm going to do this, and I'm going to be the guy that says this is the way it's done. For that alone, like, that's fantastic. And I think when I look at Hossa, it's not the same thing. But he is a generational player in his home country, and what he's done here, and could have done even more if, you know, injuries and skin conditions and everything that went along with that didn't factor into this. I think he's a no-brainer.
I don't know if he'll get
it's not the first year. It's not like baseball first year, but there is a first year criteria there, and I don't know if he tops.
Yeah, and I think Iginla does. I think Iginla gets in on the first year with all of his individual credentials. Never won the cup, but his individual credentials are through the roof. But you look at Hossa, Sean, not to just belabor the point, but he is one of the best 200-foot players that I have seen play the game. Bar none, one of the best 200-foot players I've seen play the game. And on the teams he's played on, he has been vitally important to the success of those teams in Pittsburgh, in Detroit, and certainly in Chicago.
Yeah, he was Patrice Bergeron before Patrice Bergeron.
Absolutely. Yeah, and not in the middle, on the wing, which
is even harder
to do, which is even harder to do. So that's next year's class. This year's class will be up in Toronto to watch them go in. Guy Carboneau, Vaclav Nedimansky, Sergei Zubov, Haley Wickenheiser, Jerry York, Jim Rutherford, Frank Brown, and Jim Houston, an 8-member class going into the Hockey Hall of Fame. And that'll do it for us. We certainly thank our guests, Keith Jones and Mike Zeisberger. And Sean, thanks for sitting in the chair again, hopping on.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. I think I hid how jet lagged I am. Hopefully the listeners don't know, even though I just told them, but we'll do it again soon.
Solid job. Next week. We'll do it again next week. And until then, enjoy the games.